Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon. We have a lot this week. I'm really excited. No pleasantries. Let's get to it.
The pandemic, as most of you know, has brought about a rise in anti-Asian crimes. And this week with the shootings in Georgia, it has underscored just how bad this trend has gotten. We will be joined by actress Olivia Munn, who has been very outspoken on the issue of hate crimes against the Asian community.
Then, while the Hollywood Foreign Press Association has been taken to task for not having a single Black member, a new report on The Wrap this week revealed the organization rejected coverage for several prominent Black projects in recent years, which led to what were surprising at the time, snubs at the Golden Globes. We'll be joined by The Wrap's awards editor, Steve Pond, to discuss. But first, let's get into some headlines.
Let's go.
Oscar nominations came out this week, and there were a few snubs and surprises, sure, but there were also quite a few records. For the first time in history, two women received nominations for Best Director, Chloe Zhao for Nomadland and Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman. There were nine non-white actors who received nominations this year, including Steven Yeun for Minari, Viola Davis for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and Andra Day for The United States versus Billie Holiday, just to name a few. And Anthony Hopkins set a record. I think this is my favorite one. He was the oldest ever nominee in the Best Actor category at age 83. Sharon, I don't know about you, but I feel like it's nice to finally have the Oscars upon us, a nice sense of normalcy in the business. What was your takeaway from all of the nominations?
Well, first of all, let me just say that it feels like the nominations were like months ago. I know it was only this week, but so much has happened this week that has shoved that out of the way that it's easy to feel like time has no meaning, which we all feel like time has no meaning. That's only a few days ago. I think what this really underscores is what can happen in terms of diversity when you make it a priority. I mean, we're going from a time when there were, you know, almost, it was so exceptional to have a Black actor nominated, to now having lots of diversity. Two of the Best Actor nominees are we've become Steven Yeun, but are Black. We've gone from a time when it was really exceptional to have an actor of color or a Black actor nominated, and we would all celebrate that, to having a year when we have multiple, as you point out, actors of color and lots of firsts. Chloe Zhao is the first, you know, Asian woman nominated for Best Director. It's really exciting to see all that happen, and it also makes what's going on over at the Golden Globes, which we're going to talk about, look even worse, because the lack of diversity in the membership is reflected ultimately through the nominations, because that's the lens that they're looking at and considering these projects through. So the fact that the Academy vastly increased its membership made this a big priority for them to diversify after having found out the horrific statistics of it being old and white and male not too many years ago. And they committed to changing that. We're seeing that in the kinds of works that are being nominated and that are being recognized. And that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think you make a good point comparing it to what's going on to the HFPA, because the Academy dealt with all of this a few years ago with Oscars So White, and they started to implement all these changes, and now we're seeing, you know, the sort of the fruits of that labor. I think it shows that putting in the effort really works. Leads to a much more diverse field. Do you have any favorites? Is there anything that's really sort of jumping out at you?
Oh, first of all, as the editor of The Wrap, I am not going to name any favorites at all. That's
okay.
Just going to get me into hot water. There's a lot of good movies. I think it's a weird Oscars year. There's no getting around that. The pandemic has made it really difficult to feel the excitement around any particular movie. You know, Mank is the movie that got the most nominations, 10 nominations, but I don't think anybody thinks that it's going to win the top categories, and it doesn't really have a palpable sense of momentum. So, you know, Nomadland is the other film that has a lot of nominations and does have some momentum, such as you can feel right now. But it's going to be a quiet year. It's going to be a quiet Oscars, and we'll take it. If we can just get ourselves back to some version of normal, that would be excellent.
Yeah, I agree with your sentiment about Mank. It feels like the kind of movie that gets a lot of nominations but doesn't get a lot of wins.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's turn to television. Sharon Osbourne's time at the talk might be coming to an end. She clashed with her co-hosts over her defense of Piers Morgan after his incendiary comments about Meghan Markle. And then it was one of her former co-hosts who lobbed accusations of racism and homophobism against Osbourne. Leah Remini, who was on the talk during its first two seasons on the air, has accused Osbourne of referring to her co-host Julie Chen, who is Chinese American, as, quote, wonton, and another slur I'd rather not say, and Sarah Gilbert, another co-host who is lesbian, as a number of slurs I'm not going to repeat here about her sexual orientation. Osbourne has denied the allegation and also has slammed her bosses at CBS, saying she felt she was set up to be attacked by her fellow co-host during a segment last week. The show is currently on hiatus. Daniel, do you think we're going to see her again on the talk?
I don't. You know, I think she's been there from the beginning. I don't know if she's like the centerpiece of the show, but she's certainly, you know, one of the main people. She's been there for years. But it seems like she's mad at the show. It seems like the sentiment against her is strong for the things that she said. She's now dealing with sort of multiple accusations of saying inappropriate things and not a good time to be accused of saying anti-Asian remarks. And I think it all adds up to she's done at the talk. But, you know, as with many things, it's a big business decision. The talk is a staple show. It's a daily syndicated thing. It's on every day all across the country. So I'm sure the producers there would rather not rock the boat, but I don't see how they get on the other side of this.
Okay. What do you think? Okay. Random question. If Howard Stern said this stuff, hasn't Howard Stern said this stuff and way worse?
Probably.
And other people who I don't listen to on talk radio.
Yeah, it's a tough business there in terms of, you know, pushing the boundaries.
Isn't that the point? Like, don't they say that stuff so people will tune in and listen to how outrageous they're going to be?
Another good point. Maybe she does survive. I don't know. I think it's tough. I don't know. I see it going either way. She seems, like I said, she seems like a very she's the staple of the show. She's been there from the beginning. And so,
Well, the whole thing gets even more complicated because Julie Chen, of course, is the wife of Les Moonves, the disgraced former head of the network, who a lot of people have asked, you know, how does she stay on the show because of her connection to Moonves. But she survived that wave of questioning and she's still on the network. And then, of course, the context of all of this anti-Asian violence that's going on and how unacceptable it is to hear racial slurs coming out particularly at a time when this is clearly contributing to an atmosphere of violence against Asian Americans. So then the question is, like, the whole point of having a talk show is to be provocative. So,
and it does seem that Sharon, from the interview she
Osbourne,
gave,
where
she's, Sharon, yes, sorry, wrong
Thank
Sharon,
you.
Sharon Osbourne, she told ET that she was angry with the producers of the show, but not so much her co-hosts. So it does seem like she at least still is good with the rest of her.
Well,
her,
I think she apologized.
Co-hosts. Yeah. So I think that definitely makes it maybe a little easier to return. I think a lot might be told that if she at least comes back for the first week and all of a sudden, you know, we see some a jump in ratings, that might be an indication that she's okay. So maybe they'll just dip their toe in, see what happens.
I don't think they can do that. I think they got to make a management decision, an executive decision. Yeah. They're either going to let her rehabilitate herself or they're going to cut ties and say, we're not this network anymore, which is what they've been trying to say since Les Moonves was, you know, dismissed after decades in power there. So, you know,
I think if I had to bet, I'd say she's done. That would be my bet.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, I would take that bet. In the current atmosphere, I would take that bet.
Yeah. All right. Finally, this week, the Grammys took place on Sunday night. And if you were just looking at all the people who said they were angry about the Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion performance, you'd assume the ratings were through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd be very, very wrong. The show only pulled in 8.8 million viewers, down a full 10 million from the year before.
Wow.
And that's a new record low by a mile. And it's a trend. I mean, ratings for every awards show have been down during the entire pandemic. And now we're just 5 weeks away from the Oscars. Sharon, do you think the Academy should be worried about this downward trend?
Worried? I mean, they should just be in kind of mourning mode because they're not mourning it with you, M-O-U-R, and mourning. I mean, they're not going to change the dynamic that's been underway here. Award shows have been on a downward trajectory for years, but nothing like this. Pandemic year, the Golden Globes were down two-thirds from where they were last year. That looks like the Grammys are about the same. Maybe it's tiny, maybe a hair less. And the Oscars, as I just said, they, you know, there's not a lot of buzz and energy around the movies. And if Mank were the movie, which is a black and white period film about a somewhat obscure Hollywood screenwriter, I don't know that that's going to pull in the start. And with Gary Oldman, you know, in the lead there, this is not exactly, you know, eye candy. So I think that the people who are putting on the Oscars telecast are probably already presuming that it's going to be way down this year. And I think it poses some very serious questions about these award shows going forward. Even once they're able to do everything in person, which I'm going to presume is going to be the case for 2022, there's a lot of momentum and sort of habit that gets lost. And I don't know if there's a way to revive that, but that's where they are.
Yeah, I think they almost have to just punt the year. They just have to say it's just between the pandemic and what it's done to the theaters and what it's done to the films that have been released. Because to your point, I think, I don't know if it's a chicken or the egg thing, but there's no real buzz about any movie. I mean, they're good. I'm not saying they're not, but there's no movie that's really like putting you over the top and getting you super excited.
I mean, a lot of the films are about people wandering through hellscapes or beautiful landscapes or hellscapes by themselves, thinking and talking, and you know that's nomad land for you in a caravan. Mm-hmm. If you have movies next year like West Side Story and In the Heights, which are musicals and full of life and music and song and performance, those are the kinds of films that are very, you know, big crowd pleasers and also lend themselves to a live telecast and doing something fun. So maybe there's a way to bring it back next year. I also think that there is going to be a ton of pent up demand. People are tired of sitting in their houses and staring at each other. So there is something really fun about seeing all the stars getting together and being on the red carpet and talking about something other than the water bill or whatever it is, you know, talking about movies. But I think it's just a heavy lift. It's an uphill climb for the industry to get and inject that excitement back in. But it may be that that's what people want. I think it'll also depend a lot on how these upcoming movies next year perform in theaters once theaters are open again, and they're starting to be.
Yeah, I think the Grammys tried. You know, they had so much of it was done outdoors, and they did all these big spaces where
I kind of liked it.
I think it was kind of good. I think they made the decision a couple of years ago that basically they're going to hand out like 5 or 6 awards and the rest is just going to be performances. So in that sense, you know, I think someone always jokes that every awards show could just be an email, and the Grammys certainly can, because they give out most of their awards even before the show starts. But I think they tried, but
yeah,
for nothing.
It was certainly, I'd say the show was certainly much more entertaining than the Golden Globe show was, which I thought was deadly.
I think so as well.
Yeah.
All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow Sharon Waxman, our founder and editor in chief, the opportunity to speak out about something she is very into this week, her wax on, and something that has her maybe particularly riled up, her wax off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Daniel. So my wax on this week is going to be a recommendation that you go out and see the film Minari, which was nominated for Best Picture and a bunch of other awards at the Academy Awards on Monday, and which is a wonderful counterbalance to this horrible news about this mass shooting in Atlanta that appears to have been aimed at the Asian community. This is a story starring Stephen Yeun, who was also nominated as the dad of a Korean family who moves from California to Arkansas, buys a farm, and tries to build their own American dream. It's him and his wife and their two little kids and the grandmother, who also is wonderful in the film and her performance. It's in Korean, and they're tilling the ground and they're trying to make ends meet. It's really just a wonderful American immigrant story, and the characters are beautifully written, they're beautifully drawn, they're beautifully acted. The fact that it's in Korean is completely immaterial, because you connect to all of the very basic human experiences and challenges that the family is going through trying to raise their kids. The kids are, you know, speak to each other in English, to their parents in Korean. You know, it's a familiar tale that has been told in lots of other communities, but hasn't been told from the experience of the Korean American community, and particularly at a time when we're facing this horrific wave of violence and hatred against the Asian people in our country. It's a great antidote to that and sends a very different and a very optimistic message. So that's my wax on. My wax off is also related to what's going on in the Asian American community, which is this sheriff, deputy, cop, official, Jake or in Georgia, who stood up and parroted what the shooter who was under arrest in the Atlanta shootings, who killed eight people, or who had, I should say, allegedly killed eight people, cold-blooded, perfect strangers to him, this outrageous mass murder, said that he had had a bad day, that he was trying to stamp out his own sex addiction, and to do so decided to take out a bunch of female sex workers. That guy, who turns out to have had some racist stuff on his Facebook page related to the COVID, I guess it was a t-shirt that had a slogan on it for COVID that was anti-Asian. He's exactly the reason why we have a Black Lives Matter movement, and we need a Black Lives Matter movement. He's the reason why we are looking at systemic racism and asking these questions about systemic racism. The idea that we could somehow find an excuse or justification or understand the mindset of somebody who goes out and murders people in cold blood is a big part of the problem that we have. And reminds me, of course, of that young man who went to a Black Lives Matter protest and ended up shooting somebody, this teenager, and had similarly, it was taken into custody without incident, is what is sort of become like the trope around some white person who wields a gun and ends up killing somebody, and then they're taken into custody without incident, when then you have somebody like a George Floyd who's accused of shoplifting and pays for it with his life. This is exactly the problem in our country, and it needs to be addressed. That's me, Daniel. How about you?
I'm just going to wax on real quick. A great Grammys analysis piece on the rap, I thought, warrants attention this week from our own Steve Pond, who you'll hear from later in the podcast. Mm-hmm. I thought it was very interesting. He focused on the fact that at the end of the night, Billie Eilish won the big award, and she used her speech to sort of like apologize to Megan Thee Stallion, because she felt Megan deserved to win. And Adele did a similar thing to Beyonce a couple years ago in 2017. And I think, you know, what I liked most about this piece is it points out some interesting trends of the Grammys that sort of don't get noticed, because the Grammys has all these different awards. But Beyonce, you know, she won her 28th Grammy this mm-hmm. week, which mm-hmm. is a record, but she's only won one in one of the big categories. She won Song of the Year in 2010 for Single Ladies. And that's the only one of like the major, major categories she's ever won. And it sort of kind of gets swept under the rug because she's, you know, won so many other awards and so many other little categories. But
right. It just seems like an oversight. Right.
Yeah. There's this trend at the Grammys that kind of we don't really notice. And Steve did a really good job of pointing that out. So I really want everyone, if you get a chance, could probably just Google Steve Pond Grammys and you'll find it real quick. But it's a really good article that really points to, you know, some of the issues that are going on at the Grammys.
Cool.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, Olivia Munn will join us to talk about the rise in anti-Asian crime, and we'll discuss the latest developments at the HFPA. Stay tuned.
This week's mass shooting in Georgia was horrific in and of itself. But it struck many of us as worse because of the wave of hate crimes against Asian Americans that has recently swept the country. Actress Olivia Munn has been using her platform to help shine a light on this issue and bring attention to this shocking trend. She joins us now on the wrap up to talk about it. Thank you so much for being here, Olivia.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, first of all, what made you feel compelled to really get involved? You've been extremely vocal. I'm following your Twitter feed. There's a lot of passion. There's a lot of pain in your Twitter comments and is in so many other people in the Asian American community, understandably. But what has propelled you really on this issue? Because it's not from yesterday that you're working on it.
Yeah. You know, my mother is a Viet refugee. I'm half Vietnamese Chinese, half American, or half white, all American. You know, this has been, you know, attacks against the Asian community have been going on for a very long time because we are seen as the invisible race in our country. It is a cultural thing for Asians to literally take it on the chin and keep going. There's a lot of underreporting because of that cultural stigma, but also because of the language barrier. There are like 80 some different Asian languages, and
right.
And it's really difficult for people to report the crimes that have been perpetrated against them. So this has been going on for a long time, but when the pandemic was weaponized against Asian Americans, it put a target on all of our backs. And it can't be open season on Asian Americans, and that's what it has been. And a few weeks, a month ago, time really is like, you know, right. Since the pandemic, time is whatever. I know.
Yeah.
Like somebody said it was daylight savings time the other day. I was like, what is that? When is that? What happened? I'm like, do we go back to 2020? What's happening?
Please know.
Whatever it is. I'm like, I don't think we need to save any more time. Just keep going forward. Let's get out of all this for a second. Yeah. But a friend of mine, his mother was attacked in Queens, New York. And this is in the middle of all the reporting of the astronomical uptick in hate crimes against Asian Americans. I mean, just in New York alone, the hate crimes against Asian Americans went up 1,900% in just a year.
Yeah.
And that is a direct link back to when the virus was attributed to China and Chinese people and blamed and celebrated and joked about in this way that really put a target on our backs. So my friend's mother was in Queens and she was at a bakery waiting to get egg tarts and got into an altercation with this guy, and there is some security footage, and you see he shoves her so violently that she is horizontal, flailing through the air. Her legs are kicking around, and she falls onto the ground, hits a newspaper metal newspaper box, goes unconscious. Police are called. She ends up having like 7 to 10 stitches in the middle of her head. It's this massive gash. I've seen the pictures of it. It's horrible. Thankfully, a bystander saw what was happening and he followed the guy and took pictures of him. And so we had these really clear pictures and video of the assault. So my friend asked me if I can help amplify, of course. Mm-hmm. So I went out to Twitter and Instagram, and I just asked the internet to do its thing, and to help us find this guy. And then I also DM'd
him. They found him, right?
They found him. Yeah. I DM'd the NYPD as well. And I asked them to do a wanted poster, and they did. And then the NYPD, they reached back out to me within, it's like one afternoon. And then the very next morning at 7 a.m. for me in LA, they said that the NYPD said, because of social media, we were able to find the guy. And so that was such an amazing moment, because it felt like that our people were seen for, you know, for that moment. It was like, okay. And that people cared. They cared enough to find this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a great example of when occasionally social media can help bring people to account. And, mm-hmm. but from there, and I hope your friend's mom is okay. That's just, I mean, I think that's part of the bewildering nature of all of this. I've been kind of marginally aware of, certainly, that there's violence and hate crimes against the Asian American community. But in the last 2 months, it feels like it's just become this wave. And Trump's already out of office. And, the coronavirus is on its way to being under control. And it just seems odd that it's filtered through now. Do you have any opinions about sort of why now, or do you feel it's just more attention's being paid to it?
This has been going on for a very long time, but I think it's just that more attention's been paid to it. And I, most or all of the credit of it really getting to a groundswell was because of Daniel Dae Kim and Daniel Wu, actors, producers.
Actors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They were just really tired of, I mean, we all, and within our community, we've talked about it, but there is that feeling of like, will anybody care? We are screaming into an echo chamber. So finally, when Daniel and Daniel put up their own money and said, you know, we got to find this guy who did this. You know, there was a man who, an Asian, elderly Asian man who was pushed and killed. And,
you know, that, is that the Oakland one you're talking about, or is that mm-hmm, a different one?
Yeah.
Yeah,
the mm-hmm. Oakland one. And so, and because of that, because they are prominent people in our industry, they were able to get the media coverage for it. You know, it's like just the acts alone weren't getting enough coverage. So we have having to use real star power and having to use their own money to try to bring attention towards this. So, that helped, and it also helped give a lot of us confidence that we could also go forward, that okay, people are like, now people are listening. And so that's mm-hmm. why when my friend reached out to me, it's like, okay, well, I don't know if this will work or not. Well, with my friend, the fact that he had such great pictures like that I knew that could do something, you know, like, and I have a really big belief in that people are inherently good. And so mm-hmm. even though social media gets a bad rap, it is just a collection of human beings. And if you reach out to them and you speak to them on a human level, then I think that you can get the result that we ended up getting.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this awful event that happened in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of talk about whether it should be deemed a hate crime, and why it hasn't been deemed a hate crime. I raised the point that even if you take the words of the shooter, which is of course not the definition as to whether somebody's charged with a hate crime or not, what they confess to, but even the fact that he's targeting women seems to me to be a hate crime against women. But of course, these are six of the women were of Asian descent. What's your take on this? How should we be proceeding, and how should we as a society be responding to this?
Well, you know, it's really frustrating when people just want to keep erasing what's happening to us, even in something like with what's happening in Atlanta. Like they want to erase it. Asian Americans make up about 4% of the population in Georgia. And yet 6 Asian women were killed, and they went to three spas that were owned by Asian people. So that's a direct target on Asian Americans. Like, out of, we're 4% of all of Georgia.
Right.
And the majority of the people who were killed are Asian Americans, and 100% of the businesses that were targeted were owned by Asian Americans. It's really easy to do that math.
Right.
And
it's frustrating for you that.
It's extremely frustrating, especially there's this thing that people want to do. Do they want to try to rationalize and justify what he did because it makes more sense to them? And it's like, okay, well, he was a sex addict. So then there's a lot of Asian women who are sex workers. And so then he went to kill them. That makes sense. There was nothing deeper to them than that. It wasn't like, oh, if you just peel, like Daniel Day Kim has been saying, you just peel one layer back and it's right there. It's this way that they want to humanize the shooter. It dehumanizes the victims.
Yeah. I think we have to take this as a teachable moment, that we use this tragedy to be better about seeing the Asian community and what our brothers and sisters in this country are going through, and listening a lot better. I still haven't seen very much about the women who were killed themselves, their stories.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people talk about that, and I think that at first you have to identify family members and let them know first. So I think that's a big part of it. This all just happened last night, so I do want to give a little bit of grace for that. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, like, and especially in the Asian group chat that I'm part of, you know, we all have different things that we all get really riled up about, and it kind of evens out, which is great, because we can all have different, you know, things that we want to speak on. For me, what actually has been bothering me so much more is the revelation that Captain Jay Baker, who was from the Cherokee Sheriff's Office, who was speaking about what happened and speaking about the shooter, he had posted racist photos onto Facebook where he was blaming the virus on China. Mm-hmm. He did that in April of 2020. And then after that came to light, he deleted them today, as if we don't already have screen grabs of them. And this is the guy who ends up saying he just had a really bad day, and that's what he did at the end of it. It's like, are you kidding me? We're all struggling, and we're not all picking up guns and going and shooting up Asian women. And the fact that, like, this guy is still in this position, the fact that he still is allowed to protect and serve, quotes around that, is just so beyond me. How can anybody feel safe? How can any person of color feel safe with that guy as an officer? It just doesn't make sense. I mean, the racism that permeates our society is just everywhere. And it really shows that so evidently in the Cherokee County. It is just I'm struggling with.
Yeah. Do you feel this person should be asked to step down?
I think he should be fired. Asked to be stepped down. Why is he there? How was he allowed to be there? How was he allowed to have a gun? How was he allowed to arrest people? How was he allowed to change people's lives? So he gets up there and he gives an excuse for what the shooter's done before there's any kind of judicial process. Like, who is he? Who is he to say this? He was just like, God, because you know what? If this guy had a different color skin or different shaped eyes, he would not be saying it was just a bad day. He'd be calling him a mass murderer. And that is the biggest takeaway for me, is that this when you kill 8 people, you're not a sex addict. You're not somebody who's just had a really bad day. You're a mass murderer.
Period.
Like, what? Why are we calling this anything else? He's a mass murderer. It's a hate crime. It's crazy how people just want to make it make sense in their heads. It's like, well, people need to understand that and make sense of a hate crime. Like, this is what we are attacked for, simply existing in our country, for looking a different way. We are attacked because we had world leaders putting targets on our back because of a pandemic that affected the entire world.
Olivia, can I ask you, and we can talk about whether, you know, Asian actors have the right to speak on behalf of Asians who live in Georgia, or, you know, that whole thing about whether actors should have political opinions or et cetera. You can kind of tell by the way I asked the question that
I don't know what line of thought that is. Is that what people are saying?
It's not that people are saying it, just in general. I mean, we've seen certainly on Fox lots and lots of rants out there over the years, you know, Alec Baldwin, be quiet, or, you know, whatever, just like, we don't want to hear your politics, shut up and act kind of thing, shut up and play basketball, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, Alec Baldwin's a special kind of guy where you're just like, okay, really, he's a little all over the
maybe
place.
That was a bad example. Okay, maybe that was a bad example.
Well, I think I have been asked about staying in my lane.
Yeah.
And this is my lane. I am a woman and I'm an Asian American. This is my lane. Like, if you want me to stay in my lane,
right on.
Today is my lane. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, when you are storytellers, like, which is what we are in Hollywood, you know, you're supposed to care about people. Like, you cannot tell stories about people and then not care about people. And there are a lot of people in my business like that. And I have come up against that myself, and I have struggled through it, and I've stood alone on many topics and many stages, because I care more about the people than the art. You know, you cannot separate the what's happening to human beings and then continue to like accept the glory and the fame and the lights and all of that. But when it comes to being in my lane, this is my lane. Today is my lane more than ever.
Mm-hmm. Do you have sort of hostility or anti-Asian, just sentiment pointed at you because you expose yourself when you put yourself out there? You become a target sometimes.
Yeah, that is a tough part of it, is seeing how many people want to attack you for speaking up and saying things that are difficult and that are hard. But I do always try to come from a place of honesty and positivity, knowing that this can get better. Right now things are tough, but it can get better. We need to hear what's happening. I do think, like I said, that people are inherently good, and I'm speaking to that, and people need to hear what's happening to us. But it is really difficult when I'm trying to be so thoughtful and measured and effective. And that is very triggering for other people because it affects their own way of thinking. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, when someone believes, it's like that they don't understand what's happening in the world. And it's easy to just keep going that way, but to show people what's happening and how unjust it is, it means that their life is going to change a bit. And a lot of people really don't like that, even if it means it's for the better, even if it means it's because, you know, that their white privilege has been holding down and abusing other people. Not that they're doing something in particular, but just the system of white privilege is something that has been damaging to minorities in this country since the beginning of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if anything good can come out of this tragedy, maybe it's that what you're talking about now is a raised awareness and a collective commitment to being more inclusive, more conscious of the way we act and speak toward all underrepresented groups, but particularly right now, the Asian community. So,
yeah. I hope so. I mean,
yeah,
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this, because it's something that, you know, our community, we do feel like we are not seen. And, you know, the model minority myth, which is something that I actually only really not that long ago really learned the actual term for, even though I've lived it. I've had my mother talk to me like that. I've had my mother always, you know, teach me to do what's right, to speak up when I see injustice, but at the same time, don't cause trouble. It's okay. Don't, you know, like, we just don't want to ruffle any feathers. And so understanding like how that has affected myself and my siblings and my mother and my extended family,
yeah.
But then how much it's affected so many other Asians across our country and what that has resulted in. You know, my friend's mom, who was attacked in Queens, she had this, when I say it went down like 3/4 of her forehead. I mean, it's a massive wound. It's a gash. Mm-hmm. And the police were called. She went to the hospital. She came back with stitches and she walked into the house. And her son had no idea, Sam, who's my friend, had no idea what had happened. And she wouldn't look at Sam. She kept turning away. And finally, he made her look at him. Mm-hmm. And he saw what happened. And she did not want to follow up with the police. She did not want to go anywhere. She's like, no. She would just because she was like, this happened. It's fine. I'm okay. I'm fine. Oh, let's just keep going. Yeah. And
wow.
And that's part of the culture is to not make any more waves, that it's okay to be a second class citizen in our own country. Linda To is the daughter of Nancy To. Nancy To is the Korean American who was attacked in New York, I think Westchester in New York. And there aren't very many Asian people in that community. And a man went up to her, got right up to her nose, and then punched her in the face or headbutted her or something. And then her nose is completely flat to her face. I believe he punched her in the face. And then she hit the ground. She woke up in a pool of her own blood.
Oh my God.
She was doing press about it. She wanted to forgive her assailant. She felt really bad about him going to jail. She felt that, you know, he needed more forgiveness. And I got in touch with her daughter and asked if I could help them with their medical bills, or if I could help them get a GoFundMe started, something, mm-hmm. because I had heard that they have no money, which mm-hmm. is also part of this, the stereotype that people have about Asians is that we're all successful and wealthy and doctors and engineers. But that's just not the case. So Linda, her daughter, was actually going around and picking up cans to recycle to hopefully pay for the medical bills.
This is a heartbreaking story.
I know, it's horrible. Nancy still didn't want to go to the hospital. She was fainting throughout the day. She couldn't remember things. She was so confused, but she just didn't want to go because she didn't want to make more of a problem of the situation. That is the culture of our people. And so it's so important for our generation, the younger generation, to step up and take care of them and to fight for their rights, to fight for them to be seen, to fight for them to be safe in our country.
Yes.
And and it's all on our shoulders, but it's what we have to do right now.
Well, you're doing it. Thank you, Olivia. Thank you for coming on the wrap up to talk about this issue. We talked about this issue last week with some Asian American journalists and the stuff that they have to endure. We did not anticipate that there would be a tragedy this week that would make the issue, you know, so important to talk about. Yeah. But apparently, we're going through something. We I am, you know, we are going to keep talking about it on this show. We in the entertainment industry have a really big ability to influence this issue. This movie that's just nominated for Best Picture, Minari, is an absolutely beautiful story of a Korean family, immigrant family in Arkansas. It couldn't possibly be more relevant right now. It's in Korean. And it's based on a true story of a Korean family. And it's a beautiful reminder of what, to your comment about being positive, of a positive message about how inclusive our society can be, and the story of this family, which tells the story really of every immigrant culture that has come to this country and struggling and overcoming challenges and trying to do the best for their own families.
Yeah, so, I think it's a Minari is such a beautiful movie. I think it's truly the movie that will touch anyone who's ever dreamt of a better future for themselves. It is the epitome of the American dream.
Yeah, it is. All right, thanks so much, Olivia.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck to you in your efforts. Thanks for being
Appreciate
on the
everything you guys are doing.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Much has been made of the lack of Black members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, but the group's issues with race go much deeper than that. A new report on The Wrap this week said the group rejected holding press conferences for several Black-led projects over the years. Here to discuss this story and the latest developments with the HFPA is The Wrap's awards editor, Steve Pond. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
All right, so actually, I'm going to start with Sharon. You were the one who helped work on this story. Explain for us a little bit about what went on with these press conferences.
Yeah, so in brief, what happened this past week was that a bunch of basically all the PR firms in Hollywood got together and issued a kind of extraordinary announcement saying that they were not going to have their clients show up to press conferences at the Hollywood Foreign Press Association until the group came forward with a really clear and committed plan for change. Okay. That in itself was pretty extraordinary. It was more than 100 PR firms. In the course of that, of reporting that out, because I got wind of that the night before that was announced, I started talking to the various PR firms about this, because obviously, you know, we know the PR firms well at The Wrap. We talk to them all the time about everything from soup to nuts. And what happened when they started getting on this group calls to talk about issuing this essentially ultimatum, they started comparing notes about their clients and what their clients of color have experienced over the years. And what they learned is that what they thought was an isolated incident of having their client's project rejected for a press conference, because you ask for a press conference from the Hollywood Foreign Press, and it's one of the ways that you get that project in front of them for consideration for a Golden Globe nomination. So projects like Girls Trip, which was a Tiffany Haddish comedy that was very successful. Projects like Queen and Slim, which was written by Lena Waithe and directed by Melina Matsoukas, which was kind of a rogue love story in 2019. And then Bridgerton, actually, which is executive produced by Shonda Rhimes, the great Shonda Rhimes, that they had rejected that for a press conference when it was coming out last December, which is this, you know, period, almost like a Jane Austen type series that became a huge hit, but it introduces Black characters or other characters of color in key roles in a way that's ahistorical, but very, you know, interesting. And that they sort of didn't about face 3 days before nominations, said, oh no, can we please have a press conference? So we reported this out, we broke the story. And then after we broke the story, it really went viral. And then what happened is that Ava DuVernay chimed in to say that when she had a press conference for her Emmy award-winning series, When They See Us, about five young Black men who were unjustly accused of the Central Park murder years ago, nobody knew what was the series was about. She finally asked them, did anybody watch the series? And then Shonda Rhimes tweeted her own experience about Bridgerton and her, you know, just anger and frustration over it. So there's clearly a lot of suppressed emotion and sort of, I think, a feeling of disrespect in the Black creative community about how they've been treated by the HFPA. And so that's what came out this week.
I'm wondering, Steve, how did these, we're talking about these press conferences and they just kind of sound like random events, but how do they actually tie into what might lead to a Golden Globe nomination? What are they like for the average person who probably doesn't go to them?
Yeah, they're the HFPA's official chance to to see the movie and to get the stories that they will then send to their publications around the world. I mean, that's how HFPA members get their stories, is at the official HFPA press conferences. So to say, no, we don't want a press conference, is basically saying, as a group, we are not interested in covering your film or your TV project. Which, you know, and that's also the way they see most of the things that they're going to vote for the Golden Globes. So, you know, it's tantamount to saying, sorry, we're just not interested in you.
It is saying that.
Yeah.
It is saying that. And one of the things that we pointed out is none of these projects got any Golden Globe nominations, which would be maybe you could say it's not a relevant detail, except for the fact that When They See Us was covered in glory at the Emmys. Bridgerton just got a couple of SAG nominations, I believe. And, and Girls Trip was this massive hit in 2019. And the Golden Globes really have a category for comedy and musical that would have, would have fit it very nicely. So another one that didn't get any nominations was I May Destroy You. We had a harder time confirming that, but we hear a lot of people saying that, it's not an HFPA type project. I don't even know what that means. Steve, you can weigh in on what you think that means. It's not their cup of tea.
Right. I mean, I think an HFPA type project in its essence is one with big movie stars. Kind of to the exclusion of everything else. It's like if it's got big new movie stars, then
why is that?
They want them to come to their press conference.
But why?
Because then they can sell stories about, look who I talked to, and to their publications. They can get their selfies with those people. And I think Ava pointed out that two of them tried to give scripts to, when she had her press conference. So,
yes, she did.
Mm-hmm. Steve, I'm wondering, Sharon mentioned this, proposed boycott by over 100 PR firms saying they're going to threaten to withhold their clients.
No. It's not a proposed boycott. It is an action that they are taking. There's been some incorrect reporting around that. And in fairness, the statement was a little vague, but having talked to all the PR firms, not all the PRs, but the leaders, I can tell you, they're not going to, they are currently withholding their talent now. And it's not in the statement, but there's a soft circle around May 6th, which is a date that the HFPA said that they were going to introduce their reform plan. So just so you know, this has actually already happened.
No, I get that. I just think there's nothing really to do right now. Like you said, May 6th, May 7th is Black Widow. So if they start pulling talent for around that, then I'll believe that this is actually a thing where they're really doing something. But for now, it feels like, I'm not gonna say an empty threat, but there's, it's kind of like, I'm not gonna give you Christmas presents for 1 year, the day after Christmas. Like there's no point.
Well, May is 6 weeks away. What are you talking about? That press conference would be normally set now and put calendared now. It seems to me that if they're waiting for May 6th to announce something, then they're not going to have a Black Widow press conference.
Perhaps, yeah. We'll wait. To me, I'm just waiting to see like an actual result.
We'll find out. Yes.
But I guess my question for Steve is, do you think this will work?
Yes, I do. I think there are two things that are going on right now that are going to force them to change. If they don't have access to the talent,
they don't have a show.
That also means they're not going to get presenters for the Golden Globes, all of that. The other thing is that NBC came out and told the LA Times that they were putting a lot of pressure on the HFPA as well. So if the company that is paying them to put on their show is pushing them, and if they're being denied access to the talent that they need, then they have absolutely no choice but to change if they want to hang on to their show.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to point out, first of all, I did want to share this anecdote because it hasn't seeped. I haven't had a place to put it in our reporting yet, but it's a good one, which I've heard from three different people now, which is that in 2013 or 14, Denzel Washington had a press conference with the HFPA and walked into the room and said, "How is it what every time I come back to this group year after year, there's never any Black people in the room?" So that was something that went around as something that Denzel Washington was upset about. But anyway, what I was going to say is that the HFPA immediately, the same day, I believe, as the PR firms announced their decision, put out a statement saying that they were going to increase membership to 100 people this year, and 13% of the group would have Black members by the end of the year, which, if you do really difficult math, is 13 people. So,
and right now they have 87. So basically what they're saying is,
yeah,
we're going to add 13 that's Black right. members.
Oh, that's more math, Steve. Hang on.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Which does not solve, you know, it takes care of one thing. It gives them enough Black members so they can say, see, it doesn't solve all the other problems with that group. You know, and one would only hope that, you know, they're going to go well beyond that, because adding 13 Black members and saying, okay, we're done, is ridiculous.
It is kind of ridiculous. And it really struck me as just kind of this chasing the horse after it's left the barn approach, just kept, you know, like trying to say, no, but we're really working on it and we're really committed and we're really doing this. I don't think that's the way to go about it. I think they just need to put their heads down, really decide to what they're prepared to do. You know, we had Tina Chen from Time's Up on this podcast last week, and we're talking about what their demands are, which is the, you know, again, like kind of hard to imagine this happening, but demanding that every member resign and reapply, the entire board to resign and be replaced, and any administrative jobs to be replaced, and also to move the ceremony to another time of year, and also a bunch of other things. But that those things are basically like, you know, kind of dissolving everything that currently exists. Steve, I don't know if you're talking to anybody at the HFPA, if you're hearing anything. They're pretty locked down over there right now.
Yeah.
Do you think that could happen? What time?
I don't think that everybody is going to resign. No, I don't think that that's going to happen. I think that because the recommendations are being, they've brought in outside companies to look at what they're doing and suggest changes. I think there are going to be changes that will be very uncomfortable for them. You know, it's not, I can't imagine it's going to amount to everybody resigning, but I think that 13 people coming in is not going to be enough. I think that they're going to have to bring in more people. I think they're going to have to change the culture of using the HFPA as a way to line members' pockets and prevent competition in their home markets. You know, they're going to have to be a lot more transparent. They're going to have to admit a lot more members, and to the point where they are seen as an organization that has some journalistic credibility.
I'd love to know how much money they actually have. I was reminded, which I could have looked it up, but I had forgotten, reminded by the LA Times article that the telecast, they have a deal with NBC to get paid $60 million a year for this telecast. And when you think about it in the framework of this is a journalistic organization, you realize it's just a crazy outlier of a situation where you have a group of 87 people. You could pay every one of them $1 million a year, you know, or $500,000 a year. If you could pay them $500,000 a year each, and they'd still have money left in the bank at the end of the year.
Right. And, you know, to be fair, they give a lot of money to charity, and they've increased that in recent years.
Yeah, because what do you do with all that money, Steve? What do you do with it?
Yeah. Well, and they pay way too much of it to their members to do things that their members shouldn't be paid to do.
Yeah. But it just raises that whole question that I keep bringing up of this imbalance between what the organization is and what it is mandated to do, sort of what rests on its shoulders, you know, in terms of marketing and the money and the fame and celebrity and that it brings to people all across the industry. And then it's all rests on the shoulders of these 87 people who are just, you know, none of them wealthy or successful business people in their own right. Yet there's all this money out there that they don't have any right to touch as a nonprofit. So it's not hard to understand why they decided to dip into their coffers because they have so much money.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Maybe I'm approaching this because
just one.
And it's the same question I've had for a couple of weeks now. One of the things that I think the pandemic has sort of done to us is we've sort of stopped using that's the way we've always done it as an excuse for things, right? Like Sharon has talked a lot about day and date releases, movie releases, and with theaters being a thing, we're now re-examining that whole process because really we didn't change it because that's just the way we always did it. Why are the Golden Globes even a thing? They have been a joke for as long as I've known them. People joke about, oh, the Hollywood Foreign Press, they're not even real people. No one even knows who they are. Couldn't we just decide to make something else the Golden Globes? Like, why is this still just NBC could pick another organization and be like, hey, you know, or build one from scratch and just be like, we're going to do this and this is going to be this big event every year because that's all it is a big event. Why is it still a thing?
Well, I think it's because the people who watch it, who give them the numbers to sell the advertising, who bring in the money, that goes to NBC and then to the HFPA, those people don't hear the stories that we hear. You know, I always thought, you know, if you open the Golden Globes by showing all the members in the room, people would go, what?
They'd all fit in a small room, first of all.
I think that this, you know, they've been going for 70 years.
70 years, yeah.
And people who aren't in the business are used to watching that show. So you can't just say, okay, from now on, this other show is the Golden Globes. People won't watch it. I mean, you know, as it stands right now, the Golden Globes are having trouble getting watched, but you need the viewers, and that's the show that has the viewers. So I think the industry has too much at stake.
I mean, that's what it is. I mean, Daniel, you ask a very good question. It's like, why does the emperor have no clothes? Like, why is he the emperor? He has no clothes. That is the right question. And the answer is what Steve is saying now, which is too many people have a stake in having a naked emperor walk down the middle of the street.
Who owns the Golden Globe? Is the Golden Globes like HFPA?
It's the HFPA's award show, just like the Oscars is the Motion Picture Academy's award show. NBC has licensed it for since the mid-90s. I think there was a moment when all of the scandal that was attached to the HFPA made them step back and cut the contract, and then they brought it back. But it's been anyway, I was also interested to read in the LA Times story yesterday that NBC now says they're losing money on it. We've been, I won't say pissing in the wind because that's very crude and we don't speak crudely on this podcast, but you know, on this issue, Steve and I have talked about it since we know each other, right? Like,
yeah. At a certain point, I found that what I did was I stopped complaining. You know, I used to write these long pieces just ripping the Golden Globes and the HFPA. And then at a certain point it was like, you know, I started writing stories saying, oh, it has no credibility, but enjoy the show. And we're at the point where you can't do that anymore.
Right.
You can't laugh it off anymore. They have to change or there won't be a show.
Yeah, something tells me we have not heard the last of the story. We'll be curious to see how the HFPA responds and if they get their act together.
Well, they've also said they're going to come on this show.
They... Well, fingers crossed.
This is a forum. I invited them. I made a big pitch to have.
I think we've invited them three straight weeks now.
We've invited them three straight weeks, but they have also said to me they are going to come on when they feel like they have they're prepared, and that's fair. So we look forward to talking to them.
Indeed. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve. We appreciate your great wisdom on this topic. Thank you much.
Indeed. And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thanks to all our listeners. Remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. And be sure to rate and review us. Let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.